Well, hello everyone. Welcome. We're back once again to talk about goings on in Venezuela, the capture of Maduro, and what it's all about. Yesterday I had Todd Lewis on. Today I have another guest, Jose, or is it Jose? I'm never quite sure.
Jose.
Yeah. Jose Nino, who has a Substack, and he's got a YouTube channel as well. I follow him on Twitter. And you've actually looked into and have some knowledge of this issue, which we'll get into, like what is the wider geostrategic and geopolitical picture around this? Because a lot of people are, you know, have been talking about the Monroe Doctrine. They're skeptical about the extent to which, you know, this has anything to do with Netanyahu or Israel or anything like that. And, you know, given that it's thousands of miles away. So we're going to have a look at, a closer look at some of those things, because, you know, yesterday we had a kind of cursory glance at it. Today I want to go in depth. Before we get there, I have to mention my new book, Foundations of Shakespeare. Beautiful edition is coming out, or it's just about to be released. You can get it on pre-order. Beautiful edition they've done. If you own the course, Foundations of Shakespeare, you can get this for 50% off if you send them a receipt. There is a sale on, my January sale, on the courses, promo code SHORJAN. When we come back, me and you will get into it with Venezuela stuff, and we'll take it from there. All right, hold on. If I can find it.
Sure. Yeah. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
SHORJAN.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale of the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
SHORJAN.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's ad mates.
SHORJAN.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
SHORJAN. And so, sure.
All right, so yeah, pick up a course today. There's a lot of theories floating around as to what this action against Maduro has been about. The dominant one, I would say, is that it's to do with securing or capturing oil. Other theories are available. I noticed one of the takes that does the rounds at the kind of MAGA-tard level is he was captured to give evidence on Dominion voting systems to prove that the 2020 election was stolen. What is actually behind this in your view, Jose?
Well, the way I see it is that the U.S. is pursuing like a form of geopolitical recalibration in its overall strategy, because for the last like 30 odd years, it has overextended itself geopolitically, and also like the trend of financialization and deindustrialization has not only impacted it domestically, it's also affected its military-industrial complex. As a result, it is going in a retro-futuristic manner to like this Monroe Doctrine type of strategy of trying to consolidate itself in the Western Hemisphere and subjugate as many Latin American states as possible for resource extraction, and also just keeping Chinese and to a much lesser extent Russian influence at bay. Because one of the bigger failures of U.S. grand strategy, especially after the global war on terror era, is that while it was spending all its time in the Middle East, basically making the Middle East safe for Zionism, the U.S. effectively allowed China to come into Latin America, become very prominent economically speaking. Now China is like the number one trading partner for many countries, especially in South America. And U.S. is, in many respects, being compelled to recalibrate its strategy. And Venezuela is a ripe target. It's the weakest link in this Eurasian bloc, of this BRICS bloc, if you will, this loose coalition. And smallest one, generally the least economic dynamic. It also doesn't have nukes, so you can violate its sovereignty much easier. However, I would stress some points, though. Talk about the Monroe Doctrine. I think this is a bit outmoded because the Monroe Doctrine was actually a doctrine of restraint when you compare it to the prevailing geopolitical paradigm we live under that the U.S. has pursued. Because back then, this was a doctrine used not only to keep European and other extra hemispheric actors out of the Western hemisphere, but it was also a tacit agreement with the great powers that the U.S. would not be intervening in Europe and other parts. Nowadays, since the end of World War II, the U.S. treats the whole planet as its sphere of influence, and there's no indication that the U.S. is rolling back its military footprint in Asia, Europe, and like the broader world. They still want to have like geopolitical ambitions. It's just that they're now shifting their priorities to certain regions like Latin America because of the fact that there's a lot of lithium and other resources that will help it in this new type of great power competition. But the idea that we're going back to some realist foreign policy paradigm is not true. And there is a Zionist twist to it because this refocus on Latin America, it dovetails with interests that coincide with like the Zionist power configuration that dominates, and it is the primary force that motivates American foreign policy actions, where they are the U.S. and also an assortment of Zionist NGOs and private networks have been able to successfully get into power, people like Javier Milei in Argentina and a lot of the broader Latin American right, which is also very connected to these Zionist networks. And as part of the Isaac Accords that were launched a few months ago, they're trying to make Latin America not just in safe for global Zionism, if you will, where Israeli interests, both in terms of like defense and also in terms of technology as well, will start embedding themselves into these countries through like the use of like spyware and other surveillance technology. And what we're seeing with the Javier Milei and these Isaac Accords is a concerted effort to maintain Zionist and American primacy in the region. And this is also happening in parts of the global South as well, especially in Africa and many countries that have large Pentecostal Christian and also populations from like Nigeria to Kenya and countries that have like this strategy of tension already built where there's Islamist insurgencies that are clashing with these type of Christian populations. And what we're seeing right now is with Venezuela. Venezuela has been a honorary member of the so-called Axis of Resistance since Hugo Chavez was elected and came into power in 99. Because Hugo Chavez was inspired by an Argentinian intellectual named Norberto Cerezoli, who was technically of the hard right, but he also consorted with many elements of the Latin American hard left. He was a very principled anti-Zionist figure. And he was always of the view, his outlook was that the real power and driving force behind like U.S. foreign policy was just making the world safe for Zionism. And that those type of that type of view influenced Hugo Chavez and played a key role in shaping his postures towards Israel. For example, in 2009, Venezuela broke all ties with Israel, all diplomatic ties, and recognized Palestine, becoming like the first country in America to establish formal diplomatic relations with the Palestinian Authority. And I would also add another thing too. Venezuela has also forged strong ties with Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and partly because Hugo Chavez himself was very much inspired by the Ayatollah Khomeini, and especially his resistance model. Chavez had a very eclectic type of ideology that blended elements of communism, state capitalism, and also elements of Ba'athism and Khomeiniism, if you will, to build like a kind of ideology to counter U.S. and Zionist influence. And since then, they have cooperated with many of these countries, like Venezuela's cooperated with Iran on drone technology, military cooperation, asymmetric planning for plans for asymmetric warfare and the like. And this has raised eyebrows in D.C. because for many of the people in the type of like Zionist power configuration that dominates U.S. politics, they see Venezuela as another state that needs to be set in line. And they've taken advantage of the recent tensions and the capture of Maduro to send the message that any country that ultimately deviates from this type of agenda where a Judeo-American primacy that does not submit to Judeo-American primacy, they will be punished in some shape or form. And this is the way I see it.
Can I ask, I mean, when you're talking about making it safe for Zionism, what does this mean? I mean, I remember when America went into Afghanistan, and people will recall the mural of George Floyd with the fist, and it was ridiculous, right? But it was like, right, we're going to kind of bomb you with the rainbow flag or bomb you with the George Floyd imagery. That was kind of in the woke era, whenever it was, under Biden. From one point of view, you could say, well, okay, America's just doing what it would have done instead, but instead of George Floyd and the pride flag, now you're getting the Star of David. Or is it more than that? Is it more than simply a cosmetic paint for American interests? Is it deeper than those other kind of symbolic examples, in your view?
Well, what I view it as in the foreign policy circles of the U.S. and just the broader political establishment, you have seen somewhat of a proxy war between the neoliberals and the more like Gentile neoconservatives of yore, and also the like who I like to call now against the Judeo-accelerationists, who often have some views that dovetail with neoconservatism and liberal interventionism. But these people, the Judeo-accelerationists, for example, they're exclusively focused on Israeli interest above all, and the interests of world Zionism, of just like these global Zionist networks.
This is like the difference, just to lay it out, because I've noticed this as well. It's the difference between the Kagan, you know, Robert Kagan, who's classical neocon, or who was that? Victoria Nuland, somebody like this.
Yeah.
Old-fashioned neocons versus the Ben Shapiro type, who is almost exclusively focused on that one little country.
Yes. So I have an article that's like the title, The Judeo-Accelerationist Presidency, talking about Trump. Because if you actually look at this foreign policy from the first term to his second term, it actually has broken several taboos that even Republican administrations of yore and obviously Democrats have never dared to cross. For example, on the issue of Israel, one of the most stark ones, I would say, is like the move of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This was something that Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Barack Obama never did. Also, people forget this, even though...
Sorry to cut you off, but why was that so significant? Like, what's the symbolic importance of moving it from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
There was a long held type of like international consensus and also presidential consensus that there was like a Jerusalem Embassy Act where of 1995, I believe, that this type of move would undermine peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Also, I would add too that even conventionally hawkish politicians like Ronald Reagan, or perceived as hawks, wanted Israel to show like actual criticized Israel and show actual restraint during its initial conflicts with Lebanon in the 1980s. Also, I would add too that the recognition of Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights was a thing that no presidency until Trump really did not dare touch as well. And the Abraham Accords too, very important here, where Arab normalization with Israel was some where they would sidestep the Palestinian issue altogether. This was something that even the these previous administrations never did, because they always saw that any effort to ignore the Palestinian issue and then just go straight to normalizing with other Arab countries, Israeli relations with Arab countries could provoke some sort of backlash. Arguably, it was a contributing factor to October 7th, because all these moves, I believe, prompted Hamas to realize that there's no point in trying to negotiate with the U.S. because they're just going in the tank for Israel. So we're going to have to get the Palestinian issue back on the table. Most importantly, with regards to Trump, in terms of taboos broken, he not only took out Qasem Soleimani, but he also bombed Iran, which was something that neither like the neoconservatives or like previous administrations did either. So he went out of his way to go further in advancing Israeli interests in this respect than even like your Bush era neocons.
Do you think it's fair to say, I mean, given that, do you think it's fair to say, I mean, everybody's got this meme, you know, they talk about the, you know, it's an occupied government and all this sort of stuff. But it sounds to me from what you're saying is that there was greater autonomy in Washington before Trump, and the occupation, the truly occupied government is now, it's the Trump admin. Yes, there's always been influence and lobbying and so on, but the president still, I mean, I remember reading stories that Bill Clinton was really angry that he was being spied on. And things like this, you know, in the late 90s, he found out that, the White House was being spied on by Mossad, and he was famously angry about it and things like this. Whereas now, it just seems like it's so closely intertwined that, you know, you just assume that everywhere Trump walks is bugged, for example, and he wouldn't be angry about it.
No, yes, it's basically total Zionist victory when it comes to the domination of like U.S. foreign policy, because back then you at least had the WASP element that could check that type of influence in U.S. foreign policy decision making, or at least a kind of independent Gentile interest, because now you just have either Shabbos goys, if you will, that will do the work for Israel, and then people of
the Lindsey Graham types, you know,
and other people that are embedded in the think tank complex that are they may not be of Jewish extraction, but they will go out of their way to do all the to carry out the Zionist agenda. And a lot of these other groups, whether it's like the liberal internationalist or just the old WASP order, have just been displaced because the previous order would have likely engaged in some type of intervention, for example, in Venezuela, just out of maintaining like a Monroe Doctrine to keep extra hemispheric actors out. But they wouldn't have all these bases, for example, in the Middle East and other parts of Eurasia. They would be pursuing a much more realistic, like scaled back foreign policy. Nowadays, the U.S. is a global consumer imperium now, and that is becoming increasingly, that has just become the bodyguard for world Zionism now. And what Trump represents is, going beyond Trump, is this total capture, this Pax Judaica, if you will, of U.S. foreign policy, where these type of previous foreign policy strains, they have been largely pushed out or have been rendered irrelevant now. And this is a very much a frightening development. And it's also, I think, that what's going to be coloring a lot of U.S. foreign policy, even in regions where you would not expect it, like Latin America, with the promotion of people like Javier Milei and the like, which is also, which I would also add to, this does relate to several things in the Middle East, where the situation in Israel, the security situation there, because of the fact that there may be renewed conflict with Iran, may make Israel not so safe for the Jewish population, especially the diaspora, and they may be looking at other countries in Latin America for as a plan B if things get really out of hand, because the history of Jewish polities has been pretty unstable, curse of the eighth decade. And if you look at factors, domestic factors within Israel, the rise of Mizrahim Jews that are just much more unstable, much more radical, and also the concomitant rise of like ultra-Orthodox that are increasingly on the dole and don't serve in the IDF. It's creating a very tenuous situation where these domestic factors and its geopolitical ambitions could create a lot of blowback and even lead to political instability within Israel, especially after October 7th and the 12-day war. There was like recent polling that showed that over like 60% of Israelis have considered like a plan B to get out of the country, at least for a bit, whether it's like in Cyprus. And then they may also consider now Argentina, which has become a very hospitable refuge, potential refuge for them. And I think that there's an element of that is coloring the new strategy in Latin America, where these countries under this Isaac Accords frameworks are going to be judged by not only like how diplomatically receptive they are to Israel, how they vote like in the UN and all that, but also how willing they are to take Israeli investment and also allow for certain Zionist agents to embed themselves in the governing and corporate structures of these countries.
Creating like a safe haven.
Yeah.
Interesting. I thought another possibility is that one of the issues they've got is they don't want, if there's a state, a government that is hostile or that is pro-Palestinian, that government then could materially support, give state support, fund proxies, you know, pump out propaganda. So in a way, by flipping them, if picture the Cold War map, red and blue, by flipping countries blue again, they don't materially support, you know, the axis of resistance, whatever it's called, and they don't, you know, because state resources are much bigger than what private individuals can do, right?
Yes,
you know,
100%.
We're talking about like billions, if not trillions of dollars that could be pumped into things. Another thing is that Iran had put significant investment into Venezuela. We're talking billions of dollars of Iranian investment in Venezuela. Of course, if the Venezuelan regime is turned or falls, that's another huge amount of money up in smoke for the Iranian regime. So if you think about it, they're bleeding out. The Syria situation was the same.
Yes, very similar, yes.
The Iranians put a lot of money into Syria, and it was about 20, 30 years of propping up this other regime up in smoke, and they can't get that money back. It's gone. It's spent, wasted time and effort and resources. So for the, you know, it's kind of demoralizing then for the Iranian regime to see yet another one of their little schemes go up in smoke. And domestically, it's not that popular within Iran, because normal Iranians are like, well, that's our taxpayer money, and you fucked it up again, right? So it kind of, it undermines support at home. And of course, they want the ultimately regime change in Iran. This is, I mean, yeah. they tried it last week or so. There were all these images of people protesting.
There could be imminent action too. Kinetic action as well coming down the pike.
So these things are, I mean, they're connected in that they're cutting off the tributaries, or the, you know, they see Iran as the, they talk about it as the head of the snake or whatever. But if you have a look at Israeli strategy, all of the places that America and Israel have hit have been the proxies, or they have been, you know, Syria, Venezuela now, you know, Hezbollah. These are all, you know, if you go right back to the start of the conflict, these are all things that Iran had, like chess pieces on the board. It could be like, well, they're taking pawns, they're taking bishops, they're, you know, until the king is isolated. That's how, I mean, that's how I've seen them explain it themselves. And it, yeah, it strikes me have something, it has something to it. What I want to get back to, though, is that a lot of people online, especially like friends of ours or people we'd consider to be on, you know, similar sort of side to us, have been citing, well, it's the Monroe Doctrine, and actually, like, this is just in American interests, quote unquote. So the counterfactual I'm going to put to you, the hypothetical, is if Israel didn't exist, would this have happened? I.e., would America, just purely through its own interests, not having a Zionist consideration at all, would it have still done this? Let's pretend it's JFK or something. Would he have still done this? That's the question.
Very likely not. They would have continued the sanctions policies for sure, because Venezuela is connected to Russia, Russia and China. And they would use other measures, other types of economic leverage to decouple the Venezuela economically, and also some defense matters. But I would add to that, it very likely would not happen, because unlike, say, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, there's no real evidence that Russia or China were going to establish like military facilities and missile like infrastructure there. It's never happened. They've done like defensive weapons transfers and all that, but it's never posed a threat to the U.S. And also, regards to, we talked about like the network there, I would add as well that Venezuela's oil rents have allowed it to build a form of petrodiplomacy through Petrocaribe and other, and fund other projects like Telesur, to propagandize against U.S. and Zionist interests and build a kind of like competing network, and also create a propaganda network to counter this Zionist American axis. And it has had an impact in Latin America to the point where the U.S. now, and this is a hangover of the Cold War, but they have been propping up more of these Pentecostal evangelical networks to the point where in Central America now, these Christian Zionists now outnumber Catholics. So I'm not very convinced about this, because first off, we got to start about with the premise that the Monroe Doctrine was the province of an America that was run by like WASPs, or at least like the original type of founding stock. This was like their empire. Now it's not your empire. It's been captured by very much foreign interests and their shadow stories in the government. That's one thing I would stress, that these people are actually the sovereign, not you and your LARP ideology. That's one thing to note, that we were living under a different foreign policy paradigm, and also a ruling class that has very different interests in mind. Because also, with regards to what's happened in Venezuela as well, despite them whisking Maduro, the Chavista ruling apparatus is still intact for now. And what I think we need to stress is the ball game has changed. We are in Pax Judaica. This is no longer the U.S. exerting a type of Monroe Doctrine, because it still has an outsized military footprint abroad. It's a global consumer imperium that is designed to make the world safe for Zionism at the end of the day. And I think people have to understand that, because you can't really talk about politics if you can't even recognize who the real sovereign is and who's like the real decision maker.
So I'm just going to try and play devil's advocate, because I've seen so many bad takes in the past couple of days that I considered just deleting my account on Twitter at one point. I was just like, what is the point of being here anymore? But a lot of, like, some people would say, well, okay, yeah, we accept all that. But for me in my life, it's going to be better. Like, this action, you know, we've taken out a commie, right? We're going to get the oil. This is going to be better for me and mine. Well, how do you respond to that?
Well, first off, again, this goes back to having just outdated political analysis and people not updating their geopolitical software. Venezuela has actually been transitioning to more of a state capitalist model over the last decade. And another fun fact, the Chavista regime has actually been persecuting its own, the Venezuela's Communist Party. And the Venezuelan Communist Party has been linked to the CIA and has actually, funny enough, criticized Chavismo for being like too neoliberal because of its state capitalist reforms. And the whole deal with Venezuelan oil, like, even that is not going to happen overnight. It will take tens of billions of dollars just to get Venezuelan production just back to its pre-sanction levels. And this oil is also heavy crude that is dense and viscous, so it requires a lot of specialized processing. So it's not going to happen as magically as many of these people envision. And this is another case of like the U.S. trying to just get on the scoreboard after bungling many of its military ventures abroad and using the pseudo Monroe Doctrine appeal, because I just think that we're living in a different epoch, and that these people that think that, oh, if we can do this in Venezuela, why can't we do this in our cities, like, to restore order in the U.S.? They're missing the basic principle that you guys are not the sovereign. Ultimately, you're not the ones calling the shots here.
Yeah, I mean, that was another, I mean, it was almost like people were picking takes off a Rolodex, right? All of them bad. Mm-hmm. But another one was, you can just do things. You can just do things. It's cool. And you can just do things. This shows what you can do with a Bronze Age mindset.
The Zionist power configuration can do things because they're the ones that actually have the power. So there's a half-truth that, yeah, someone can do things. It's just not you.
But I guess your view is, I mean, my view is, okay, they can do things because they have access to one of the biggest armies in the world. But you cheerleading it along really has quite cuckolded energy to me. Like, it really feels, to me, it feels cucked and almost like kind of like Reek from Game of Thrones or something. But a lot of other people like seem to want to like live out vicarious power fantasies through the use of the American army to do this. I mean, one of the worst has been Matt Walsh. Matt Walsh is like, I mean, he is literally posting things like, right, he quoted this Canadian guy and he was like, oh, the thing is, what you want to understand is, we're your boss. You know, it's just like, it's just so, to me, it feels like beta rage. You know, like beta, kind of like, you're living out some, you're a tough, powerful guy because you watch the army, not under your control, do something. Meanwhile, he's sitting there literally taking orders from Ben Shapiro in his actual life. And yet he's playing out this fantasy online. You know what I mean?
And he lives in a community that is increasingly populated by so-called skilled migrants from South Asia to Africa that are conveniently also pretty philo-Semitic or pro-Zionist and are going to become part of like the new managerial class that's going to lord over you. So, yeah, it's at best like a spectator sport mindset, and at worst, just being like a cuck. Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird, but like at the minute, So at the moment, I mean, obviously this is a developing story, but that was about Canada, you know, and people are sharing these maps with, you know, all of North America colored in the
Star. Oh, I could go into that too.
And then some people are doing the entire Americas, like every South American country in the Stars and Stripes. And then, of course, on top of it, and I'll let you come in a second, there's an actual real diplomatic crisis with Denmark because Trump keeps on saying we're going to take Greenland. Right. Why don't you break? Like, what are all these maps? Like, what are they setting up to genuinely do this? Or
it's actually kind of funny because when I got into politics, I got in more through like a conspiratorial route. And I remember this like almost two decades ago where people were railing against the so-called like North American Union, like a project to just use like NAFTA as a springboard to effectively integrate and eventually annex Canada and Mexico to this North American Union. Many people on the right oppose this for obvious reasons of national sovereignty. But it's funny now with Trump, because he's got the only Nixon can go to China effect, where only Trump can actually sell the idea of a North American Union under like the premise of like based American exceptionalism and annexation, and actually kind of go through with it and manufacture consent for it. It's hilarious because these same people cheerleading that may have been in like an InfoWars forums and other conspiracy forums back then, complaining about NAFTA and these efforts to integrate the North American continent. And I do believe in a really ham-fisted way, Trump has expressed the beliefs of several members of the American ruling class that want like 1 billion Americans. That's like the whole concept that guy, the Cuban Jewish pundit Matthew Iglesias, has had of trying to attract as much biomass as possible through a combination of mass migration, natalism, and all that, to have as many consumer units at the ready for great power competition against China and all of that. And I think that Trump has in a ham-fisted way expressed some of like the desires of the ruling class that just want to continue to have as much people as possible. This also connects to Cuba as well, which I think the U.S. has long coveted, even to the early days of the American Republic. And they just want as many of these consumer units to keep the big red line going up, mm-hmm. hit the diversity quotas, and have it just as much like human flesh as possible to put into like a potential like military meat grinder, and also to just revitalize this entire global imperium. And I think Trump has largely created conditions for this, because I could bet you 10 to 20 years from now, you'll see like some think piece in like a liberal outlet that'll be like titled, "Maybe Trump was right. Maybe we should just push for this annexation and a greater like North American Union," because that this whole system is predicated on just nonstop growth, and not just like universe of foreign policy, like imperium abroad, but also an ever expanding economy and all that.
You see, this is the thing. Every state, every empire wants manpower. This is something I've tried to explain to people, because in this country, there's this big whole debate on remigration, right? And a lot of the British right just keep on screaming remigration now and all this sort of stuff. And I'm saying, like, look, there's 38% of all kids are non-white currently in British schools. They're not going to deport 38% of all kids, because every state wants manpower. So you can say it as much as you want, but once you're actually in power, it's not going to happen on that scale, because every state wants to increase total count of heads. So what you're talking about is very interesting here, because what it would mean for the America, if this actually did happen, or any move to, I mean, all I'm thinking is, right, you add Canada, okay, that's a lot of Canadians added, so that, but it's also quite a lot of Indians added at this point as well.
That's one of the main animus there, yeah, because they're going to get plenty of new managerial class types there amongst that population, which is very docile.
You also get, if you add Mexico, like, Mexico is all Mexicans. So, I mean, I'm one of the things I can see happening in America is an attempt to reclassify Hispanics as quote-unquote white. I think that will because I mean, I've always wondered about the category, the racial category Hispanic in America. I know there's some admixture with Native Americans back in the day and so on. But I mean, I just can't, if they're going to go ahead with these sorts of things, there's going to have to be a way to kind of sell it to the population who are there. Because one of the side effects of Trump is that people have just become, like, I guess you'd say, like, way more racist over the past decade. From where we were in the 90s to now, people are a lot more kind of open about talking about these sorts of things. And I just can't see how they're going to be able to manufacture consent for it unless there's a recalibration of how these people think of these racial categories. But, I mean, especially the planning of uniting the entire continent.
Yeah. Actually, you have one of the more interesting developments, and I've written about this because I do specialize in doing research on Hispanic voting trends and their outlooks in the United States, is that one of the interesting forms of blowback of the so-called Great Awakening, which has created a kind of like black versus white dichotomy in U.S. domestic politics, is actually that many Hispanics now are very much like tactically siding more with whites. For example, at the height of the George Floyd riots and protests, one of the most interesting factoids I've found was inside the Democratic coalition, the only group that supported a military crackdown against BLM and all the assorted actors on the streets were the Hispanic Democrats. And they were like 53%. They wanted like a total crackdown. And Republicans actually were able to very much cynically exploit that in the so-called woke era to get record Hispanic support for Trump in 2024. This has been a trend, I've argued, since the George Zimmerman drama, where Hispanics have been gradually going toward the Republican side and siding with more of like a party that dog whistles to whites, because they do have some certain segments of the Hispanic population in the United States exhibit characteristics that the Catholic ethnics have. And there could be a concerted move to that. Also, mass migration has diluted black political power in many respects. You go to cities from Miami to LA and you could see a lot of displacement by not just Hispanic migrants, but also gangs and other elements of the Hispanic community push out blacks. And I do think that if these trends hold, especially now that there's more of a legal focus on migration, it will lead to diluted black power in addition to diluted European influence in America. You can have like a hodgepodge of groups altogether where not one is like dominant. That's what I'm seeing now. And this is a trend I've noticing too in the Anglosphere with declines in like irregular immigration. You see this with the halt in border crossings in the US and also the marginal rollbacks, at least, or the slowdowns in the rate of migration to countries like in Canada and the UK. I think you're going to see a general pivot, especially in the United States. I think it's going to be much more pronounced in the United States to so-called skilled legal migration and all that. And I think you will, this will result in a different type of color paradigm that's no longer black and white, like the way that it was like in the woke era. It's going to be just a hodgepodge of groups that will kind of like maybe be white passing, if you will, or not form like a cohesive block. It's the perfect like divide and rule strategy that allows for a minoritarian sect to continue to run things in U.S. politics.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is not like no offense intended by any of these comments, but looking at the history of Latin America, strikes me that Hispanics like a strongman. They're like pretty much every right.
Yes.
So, in a way, like I've seen some people like mock up Trump as a South American dictator, or like a Maduro or a Pinochet. Like he kind of already has some of these characteristics. So from a certain point of view, it's not that surprising that core group of Hispanics would like somebody like Trump. So I wonder if a kind of quote-unquote authoritarianism will increase as a tendency in American politics as it becomes more Hispanic. Because, you know, American, as it becomes more like South America, the politics will become more like South America. Stands to reason.
The Trump is, like, let's just be blunt here, is very third world and brown coated in many respects. He's not like your typical Republican in terms of the aesthetics, like a boring type of think tank type or like the WASP of yore. He has an aesthetic that's very appealing to not just like Latinos, but also like Nigerians, where he's incredibly popular in, and a lot of like the global South, where there's a big time hustler mindset amongst these groups of people that they generally relate more to Trump than just some generic white politician in the United States. But one thing that is interesting, though, is that Hispanic migration, with the exception of some of the like Central American backwaters like Guatemala, Honduras, is it has been declining a lot, actually. And it's now just being, you're seeing other groups like obviously like South Asians, like Indians, and to a lesser extent, sub-Saharan Africans start to come in. You're seeing like the development of like an overclass migrant group that's largely South Asian and also Nigerian emerge in the U.S. And the Hispanicization of the U.S. is pretty pronounced in the Sun Belt, especially Southwest. But I think as well, you're going to see a lot more skilled migration too, because Hispanics do have latent and like vestigial forms of anti-Semitism. And the ADL has commented on this. They have reports that a lot of minority groups from Black, they worry about like Blacks and Hispanics manifesting that. And that's why I think that some of like the grand strategy of like the U.S.'s like immigration policy is just to bring as many people as possible from other areas that especially like India and Christian Zionist parts of Africa that won't challenge the system as much as possible, because these groups, as I've documented as well, since October 7th, countries like Nigeria, Kenya, and India, they've either been still pretty receptive to Israel or Zionism or very indifferent to it, whereas the rest of the world has just been in horror since that. And that's why I think there has been a general acceptance by the ruling class, especially in the U.S., to no longer have like a completely open border. You've seen record low border crossings, but this has been a recalibration that started even at the end of Biden's, like the last half of Biden's final year in office, where they were beginning to crack down on the border crossings. They want to maintain some degree of order, but they're still going to get consumer units. And that's why I tell people that, yeah, you can cheer about the low border crossings, but you're going to get a new wave of migration. It's just going to come in legally through beach expansions and all that.
So, you know, going back to the takes that people have had, one of the takes going around in this country, again, from many of my buddies on the so-called right, has been basically, okay, great that you've done this. Keir Starmer's next. Come and invade us. Next, okay, where I thought was just, I mean, okay, you could say it's a joke, it's a meme or whatever, but I actually think that there is, you know, behind this humor, there is a kind of truth to the fact that I get the impression that the Zionists that we're talking about don't really like the British establishment, and that they certainly don't like this British government right now, the Keir Starmer government. Do you see, like, how do you see the European, like the actual old Europe, whether it's Britain, France, because they've been quite critical of Israel too. We've already seen some attempts to like sanction Ireland and bizarre things like this. Are they just simply going to try to take over each of those governments, or like, are they going to try to punish Europe in some way? Like, where does Europe fit into this new empire that you're talking about? Well, this development, yes, ongoing on empire.
So you've got the emergence of what I like to call like Zio populism, or has have how you've called it slopulism. there's definitely Zionist money and actors that are propping this up, whether you like the usual suspects like Laura Loomer, Tommy Robinson, these people that are financed by Zionist billionaires in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And they're creating these big networks of populist parties. It's like a Sorosism of the populist right, where you have like the aesthetics of populism and all that. They'll campaign on that, but the revealed policy preference that will be implemented is actually just Zionism. There's no real. And I think
every country gets their own melee, something like this, you know.
Yeah, that one is even more curious because they're using a radical libertarian aesthetic with it, mm-hmm. like a guy who will talk about Rothbard and all that. But yes, this strategy, you're seeing it with like the Vox party in Spain, because Spain, curious enough, say what you want about their libtarded government, they have questioned like they've been very reluctant to do the NATO spending of hitting the 5% mark. Like the prime minister says, like, hey, the Russians are not going to be crossing the Pyrenees anytime soon. They've also have really decoupled from Israel. And traditionally, Spain has been pretty anti-Zionist. It didn't recognize Israel until like the late mid-1980s. And they've largely decoupled there. And they've also played more footsie with China too. And yeah, you mentioned Ireland. I think there's this type of Zionist versus like neoliberal interventionist like proxy war is playing out also at the European level, and the populist parties who many of them have made strategic alignments with Israel and other Zionist groups, they are effectively a stalking horse for this thing. And also in light of like the backdrop of Brexit, it has created an opening for the US to potentially have more influence over British affairs as opposed to the EU. And as a result, you have the UK, like discourse now, people talking about it as a vassal state of the United States. And these type of dynamics are definitely in effect. You will see a lot of these governments in Europe who deviate from this Judeo-accelerationist consensus. They may not get like the most like naked forms of regime change, but you will see scandals somehow emerge involving that political class, other forms of destabilization measures designed to bring these countries to heel. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, since the end of World War II, Europe has effectively functioned as a vassal of the U.S., and it's become more pronounced as well after the Russo-Ukrainian War broke out with all the sanctions and all that. They've basically have become economic vassals in many respects to the U.S., and they don't have much sovereignty like as opposed to previous decades.
Yeah, I mean, on the front of the kind of propping up of the sloppiness, as I call them, I have noticed that, because the thing is, once you're aware of how these networks work, I think they're incredibly easy to spot, okay? Because somebody's not just in it, they're always in it 110%. Okay. So as soon as you're in it, you like they're full, like there's things I look for, like hardcore counter jihad. Okay. Avowing Tommy Robinson, things like this. Mm-hmm. So when Jordan Peterson became fully enmeshed in that network, it was super obvious. He was hanging out with Ben Shapiro, he was interviewing Tommy Robinson, you know, there's a set of talking points. So when I look at the populist leaders, somebody like who's that guy in the Netherlands?
Oh, here Wilders, yeah.
Like no, Wilders is 100% part of that. Right, he is he is in the network. Mm-hmm. Farage in this country, tentative. He's not fully in. He is not like the Reform UK have been unwilling to go 100% counter jihad. He was lukewarm about this Venezuela thing. There's something in. And the reason I think is because Farage is preparing to be the prime minister, which means that at some part of the British establishment has to be happy with him, okay? But there's all sorts of little tells. He won't avow Tommy Robinson. He's got Zia Youssef there as a main, who's a Muslim, who's a main plank of reform. He's not willing to go all the way, right? And I can just, I can go through a list of politicians and tell you who is and isn't part of them. Like Liz Truss is part of that network, okay? And she's now the former prime minister. Robert Jendrick in the Tory party is fully part of the Zionist network. A guy called Ben Habib is fully part of it because of the talking points, because of the little tells. Whereas Nigel, not willing to go fully in. So that is one thing I haven't quite worked out yet. And I looking from the outside in, it's hard to tell, but I get the impression that even in France,
Le Pen and Bardella.
She's not fully in. Yeah, go on.
One thing interesting about Venezuela, Le Pen and even Jordan Bardella, who to an even greater extent, he's seen as part of like that kind of Zionist network. They were critical of the U.S. operation to snatch Maduro. They were actually like vocally critical about that. So there's a, there is like an emerging trend in Europe where I think there are in the political classes of Europe, especially France, given it's the Gaullist tradition, there's still like a residual element where there's some people, especially on the Gentile elements, that they do have cold feet on certain U.S. like imperial excesses, because they could see that same type of special military operation energy that was used in Venezuela potentially used against Europe. That's the fear, and it's very rational because the U.S. treats it under Trump. He's just very blatant about it. He just says the quiet part out loud that you guys are just vassals, that you are our playthings, and you will do as we say. And if we want to annex Greenland, we will do so, because what are you going to do about it?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I can see, okay, the American army is big, but, you know, Europe's got like 700 million people there. And the combined, like, if everybody did the 5% NATO spending, you know, they could get their army, like it wouldn't take that long for the European armies to get back up to snuff. I mean, they'd have to start reindustrializing.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I do see the seeds in the possible downfall or breakup of, you know, NATO or the American Empire.
Yes.
In these sort of moves, because like from the day, like Denmark, okay, they're not a big country or anything, but they've been quite model members of, they've been like model allies to the US, model members of, you know, the Alliance of Nations. Yeah, they're a NATO member. Now you've got a NATO member threatening another NATO member. Like, what's the point of NATO? So, I mean, just to go back to what we were talking about before, this new way of doing things, this new kind of Judeo-American thing that you're talking about, do they ultimately want to get rid of NATO? Trump has talked about it before. Do they just want to like do away with the apparatus of legitimacy around it and just have naked power decide things now?
They, what may happen is, yeah, it could just get defunct because of just imperial constraints where they have to just cut it loose, or it may just exist on paper, but in function, it will not operate the same way before, and the U.S. may just focus exclusively on Eurasian affairs. But also, I mean, there are efforts. I mean, the whole division of labor strategy that Pete Hegseth has promoted of getting these countries to just like spend a bunch of money, and this will result in not just like the U.S. military industrial complex getting richer, but also lead to the impoverishment of many European countries. It will put these countries at the brink, especially with their welfare states. We could see, conceivably see, the end of a lot of the European welfare state models because of the fact that they're like being compelled to make all this spending increases, and it'll create destabilization. I'm not sure, because there's a lot of institutional inertia, and the one thing that stayed always consistent about U.S. foreign policy, even under Pax Judaica, is that it sees the whole world as a sphere of influence, and they would still want to maintain a lot of these power structures. They might just they may purge people. What I think is very conceivable, they may purge people within NATO that will like criticize the excesses of NATO and just recalibrate it to people, make it just more Zionist friendly. I mean, NATO has never really challenged Israel like credibly. So, I mean, they may just start purging internally and going through these institutions and making sure that they have like actual Judeo-American agents that will do that. But I think with Europe, it looks pretty bleak because of the fact that many of these politicians have not really gotten the score that they're ultimately vassals, and the U.S. has very hostile interests towards them. And that honestly, like these NATO like spending increases, I mean, they might be relevant for people like in Eastern Europe that have historical grievances with Russia, but for like somebody like people like in Spain or whatever, it doesn't make any sense because they don't face that type of challenge. And yeah, I mean, who knows what will happen? I think you're going to see a sloppulist type of color revolution model, though, start to emerge in Europe to try to bring these countries to heel. That's going to be tried out first because the U.S. does right now, I think, is more interested in using hybrid warfare to shape policy outcomes abroad.
Now, there's one potential spanner in the works, and I'll let you go after this, but this is kind of interesting. Strikes me that the Democrats in America are more aligned with the Keir Starmers of this world and the European leaders and the old kind of globalist order and Davos and the WEF and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, the Democrat left has become pretty pro-Palestinian. It looks to me like the Republicans may get their ass handed to them in the midterms because I just can't see the GOP pulling out huge victories after what they've I think no matter what anybody says, Trump has lost support, right? He's lost like maybe 10, 15, 20% of where he was, right, when he came in. So then in the next election, Trump can't even run. So they got like J.D. Vance, so they've got, Ted Cruz has talked about running. But the fact is that if we have a Democrat president, can't the Democrats roll all of this back? Because then, or are they going to be 100% on board with all this stuff as well?
I'm not very convinced because these type of agents, the Zionist power configuration is no longer just like a lobby that's placing external pressure. They're already well past the gates. They already have a lot of levers of power. You look at it with Zoran Mamdani, where they have Jessica Tisch. She is the police commissioner and is the heiress of the Tisch family fortune. And the Tisch family patriarchs, whether it's the grandfather or her father, have been connected to the Zionist power configuration. And I believe Lawrence Tisch, the grandfather, was part of the mega group that shadow network connected to Jeffrey Epstein. And right, you have these people already embedded, and Democrats are going to face similar problems too, just like how you have people in the populist right that are constantly in the U.S. constantly complaining about how things aren't getting done. Well, you're going to see that dynamic display with Democrats, where the structure now is so infiltrated by these people that they're not going to see much of their pro-Palestinian stuff ever implemented. You might see rollbacks of the excesses, but you won't see like a fundamental reconfiguration of this class unless this class is fully disempowered. What I do think you're going to see in the U.S. is that it's increasingly unstable because of the fact that you can't really build the same type of majorities that ushered in the super majorities that ushered in like the New Deal or other great leap forwards, like the Great Society and all that. And you have a constant like turnover presidencies and also very thin margins. Even Republicans, their trifecta in Congress, it's not very decisive. So these countries, the U.S. is not very governable except for like Zionist matters. And that's the thing, that's the feature, not the bug, of the system, that it's become so hyper polarized and everything that it can't function well, and it's reliant on executive orders that get rolled back. But in terms of those measures that you were talking about, like anything that's regards to Zionism, I don't think it's going to be really checked in any meaningful way. You may see some stuff rolled back, like regards to border security measures and all that, but I think the system is going more towards a model that maintains like some degree of order in the immigration system, of getting like skilled migrants that help build out like certain strategic sectors of the economy. And that continues a lot of the post-World War II order with certain recalibrations here and there. But I don't see anything fundamental being changed. And yeah, Democrats have the advantage in 2026 and maybe 2028 as well, if the economy continues going down the tubes. But you're not going to see any fundamental shift until there is actually like a genuine populist movement that identifies who the real sovereign is and challenges that entire power structure and clears it out effectively.
Interesting. Very interesting. Last thing, just given that you mentioned him, Mamdani, right? Why did Trump send Maduro to New York? Because it wasn't that long ago where he was saying, oh, if Mamdani gets in, we're going to do this, that, and the other, call in the Federal Guard and all this. New York has fallen. And then he captures Maduro and sends him to New York. Why would he send his prized, hostage, I don't know what you'd call him, abductee? Why would he take him to New York, of all the places?
I mean, that's where the real power center is, ultimately. That's where the Zionist power configuration is very much, like, clustered in. That's where the real decision-making is done. And through a lot of these shadowy networks and all that, it's not D.C. any longer. it's largely high finance and all these groups. That's where they consort. And all this stuff about Mamdani, like, is going to create this mass exodus of this. I mean, it's kind of true that South Florida has actually become a much more prominent type of area where policy decision-making is being made, especially in right-wing Zionist elements. But as I said before, Mamdani is still dealing with a well-embedded structure where he's getting flack for maintaining this Tish character as New York police commissioner. So, like, he's going to – I think there's going to be a lot of fell-for-it-again awards on the left with Mamdani coming soon. There's going to be a lot of black-pilling and other stuff because the – I just think that it's going to take a lot more. It's going to take people that look at things in a much bigger picture, that understand like the real power configuration, to challenge it. Because I think there are elements of the political class that know, like, yeah, this whole talk about Mamdani being this radical communist that's going to like expropriate massive amounts of wealth, this is just like campaign speak, because they know who are like the actual agents in power and the type of real constraints he's going to face. And that's why Trump is willing to play ball, because it's still New York is still occupied territory, regardless of who is nominally in charge of it, like the mayor's office there.
Interesting. Well, I mean, when you were talking about South, I was reminded of Godfather 2. Do you remember when Michael Corleone leaves New York and goes down to see Hyman Roth? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. The Florida thing reminds me of that a little bit. But because he's like retired and stuff, but he still seeks counsel and all this. But why did they let Mamdani win? They ran Cuomo and they kind of backed Cuomo with a little, but it still strikes me as odd that, you know, the crown jewel in the empire, New York, would be allowed to fall symbolically to this communist Muslim guy.
Well, I think you do have like several like demographic factors to consider. Also, like Trump, the system has to give the people like this illusion of hope, mm-hmm. both on the right and the left, where you can't govern like a comic book tier villain, like a Saturday morning type of villain, where they have to at least give some buy-in to the population, whether it's through like right-wing populism, this type of controlled populism, or on the left. And Obama kind of embodied this too. His campaign, many people, it's a containment strategy. And I think they have to play ball like that, or else you'll get more situations like Luigi Mangione, for example. You'll get when people no longer see the ballot box as a viable option for political change. They'll go to the bullet.
Yeah, he was the guy who shot the billionaire, right?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. All right, well, I mean, I could talk to you all day because there's so many things to get.
Yeah, so yeah.
But, interesting. So you don't think, I always try to like extract a bit of hope, believe it or not, from somewhere. You don't believe the 80-year curse is real? 2 years left, 3 years left?
I mean, who knows? I think we will. One of the good things about the political process we're going through is that the post-World War II consensus is breaking down. I actually like some of the instability that's happening because it creates power vacuums for people, like dissident spaces to fill. And post-October 7th, I've seen more people actually talking about real issues now and talking about like factions and power. When we start talking about factions and where power is actually being concentrated, I think that is a plus because it's now people are going beyond just like voting for R versus D. They're actually looking at what brings these people into power, and then we can figure out solutions to these problems. Because when people take things at face value, I think your politics are just on the fast track to just stupidity and getting played ultimately.
Well, that's what I thought was happening. And then this happened and I was like, oh shit, there's been everybody's literally a retard. That's been the blackpilling thing about this week, because I thought, right, the past year, there's been great progress in people looking beyond just what's on the, and then it's like, oh, my entire feed is acting like it's 2003 again.
Yeah.
How much of that is real? Or is it all, is X so botted now that it's impossible to tell? But, or are so many influencers just paid off to give like the shit as takes you can imagine? What's going on there? Or are people just that stupid? I always think, like, when you talk to a boomer, right? You red pill them for like a day or so. Then they, you know, they go back and they watch TV. The next time you see they reset, it's like a factory reset. And I feel like many people this just past week have just had a factory reset.
Yeah, X has become a bubble, if you will, because I tend to think that the base of followers tend to be more switched on than the influencers themselves, like they're, and the take sellers. They tend to be better on these issues. And if you go to like the broader population, they're just like, what the hell is going on when it comes to these interventions and whatnot? I actually think when I've been in this game for a bit that I'm seeing just more people question stuff. Yeah, there's still like holdouts, like people that engage in very wishful thinking and promote regime narratives. But I think things are going, for the most part, it's a roller coaster. It's not going in a linear fashion, but I do think that people are beginning to question more of like the prevailing narratives, but it's not going to go in a smooth fashion, unfortunately.
Great. Well, where can people find your stuff, Jose?
Yeah, I am most active on X/Twitter at Jose El Nino. That's where you get some of my like generic musings on a day-to-day basis. But for my most of like the substance of my work, you go to Jose Nino Unfiltered, my Substack, josealnino.org. That's where I write about a whole host of issues, domestic and geopolitical. I'm also very active in certain outlets like the Libertarian Institute, Occidental Observer, where I do talk about geopolitics and certain domestic issues. But yes, those are the main spots you can follow me.
Great. All right. Well, I'll just remind people once again, Foundations of Shakespeare is on sale. The promo code is SHORJAN for the courses. And yeah, it's been very interesting. Good to finally meet you. Now,
likewise,
just to warn you,
pleasure.
It's going to kick us out. All right. So I'll have to say bye, because once I hit this, we're out. We're kicked out.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Thank you again.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.